Did you know that if you work in an office, there's a 60% chance that you work in a cubicle and that you almost certainly dislike it? 93% of the people who work in cubicles would prefer not to. That's a lot of unhappy employees. So how did the fabric-covered box invade and colonize our offices? Nikhil Saval is the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace, and he traces the birth of the cubicle back to Germany in 1958 and the invention of something called the office landscape, or in German,
the Bürolandschaft. It kind of comes out of the ferment of post-war Germany. It's after the war. They had been closed off from a lot of ideas during the Nazi era, and suddenly all these sort of ideas come rushing in, including American management ideas, and so there's this real ferment around all kinds of things, but work in particular is one of them. And so these two brothers from Hamburg, the Schnelle brothers, they want to create a more egalitarian office. And they want an office that's not reflective of power, of hierarchies, the kind of corridor of private offices reflecting status and prestige, and then the people in the center doing the kind of clerical work. Mm-hmm. Reflecting their kind of lowly status. They thought, no, workplaces should reflect the way you work, and they should be based on communication, on paper flow. And so the office landscape is really the origins of what people call the open plan office. There were no walls. It was the desks arranged in these clusters based on your teams or, you know, what you were working on. If you look at the kind of plans for them, they look really chaotic. They're just desks everywhere.
It looks like a high-tech company today.
Exactly. It's meant to reflect what kind of work you're doing. And there's this invisible course of communication and paperwork that is supposed to be running through this office. This was seen as just a huge change. It was a big hit in Europe, and then it migrated to the UK and from there to the United States. And people were used to this sort of international style buildings of the Lever House, things like where there were just regimented desks and glass curtain walls. It was all about just prestige and power. And then to see this that was supposedly egalitarian and free-flowing, that was really exciting for a lot of people.
And when it came to the U.S., one of the people who really fell in love with this concept is this designer, Robert Probst. And you read a lot about him. He's the guy who kind of gave us the cubicle, right?
Yes, poor Robert Probst, who I think never wanted to be known as the inventor of the cubicle. But it's true, he was this sort of maniacal inventor, designer of sorts, although he was never trained properly in the way that, say, the Eameses or Nelson or, you know, other great designers were. He thought a lot about what needed to be fixed about work, and it mainly came from his own work setup. He just realized that workplaces were organized in totally the wrong way. Like the inventors of the Bürolandschaft, he thought that workplaces needed to reflect the way people worked. You know, the original office model was basically based around the factory, the rows of desks that you see in films like The Apartment, or now, again, in Mad Men, those steno pools, accounting pools. They were supposed to be like paperwork factories. But for Probst, he thought that work was not like that, that what people were doing was essentially a kind of mental labor. The term knowledge work had sort of just come into being. And so he wanted to create a furniture system that would be conducive to that kind of work.
So he created this design. He called it the Action Office for Herman Miller back in 58. So what was his Action Office?
There are sort of two versions of it. The version that was the biggest hit came out in 1968, and it was this mobile, three-walled, fabric-wrapped walls that were obtusely angled and hinged. They were meant to effectively be just dividers. They could create an individual workspace for someone, or they could be arranged to create a kind of mini conference room. It was meant to be flexible and open. You could pin things to it. You could individualize it. That was the sort of workstation, that's what he called it, that he created. And above all, it was not meant to be put in place. Probst thought that the office was, he called it a facility based on change. There were lots of things. It was constantly changing. So the design was meant to be accommodating to whatever might come to the office, whether that was computerization or new kinds of work, new kinds of workers. You couldn't foresee it. And so you had to just do as little as possible in a way to plan for a new kind of workplace.
So it's this kind of utopian vision of the knowledge worker having more and more autonomy and freedom and flexibility. And instead, poor Probst, it turns into the cubicle.
That's right. It's really, I think, one of the great ironies of office design, of office work. It comes out in 1968, and it's an immediate hit, both with designers, but also with just the mainstream press. I think there's this New York Post piece about how they wonder how office workers could have put up with the designs they had for so long, and Action Office 2 just obliterates all of them. And other furniture companies catch on to this. They start copying Action Office. Over time, what starts to happen in the 70s and 80s is that managers realize that it doesn't really matter whether you want to create autonomy for workers or not. What Action Office and its copies really offer is a tool for cramming more and more workers into less and less space for very little cost. I mean, there's a certain tax write-off. It's depreciable. It's very cheap to have Action Office, much cheaper than a permanent work office. And so it starts to multiply. And you hear designers who are very excited about it initially come out of the installations of these of Action Office or things like it, just completely disheartened, like they have no idea what they've just done.
Another kind of office is this shared office space, the concept of co-working. So different companies will share one central office space. You visited some of those, right?
Yeah, I visited a couple of these at least. And there are sort of a number of models of these. The most common, actually, is the co-working facility that is geared towards freelancers. The co-working facility is in some ways parasitic on the rise of independent contractors and freelancers, which is a growing part of the economy. Nobody's quite sure how much, but it's somewhere between 20 and 25% of white-collar workers might be freelance.
Essentially working for themselves.
That's right. You would think that these workers would not ever want to go back to an office. Like, why, if the sense of the office is about control and authority and cubicles or what have you, why would you go back? But actually, it turns out that in a way to escape the isolation and the very high potential for exploitation in freelancing, you want to be around other people. You want to see sociability, you want to see culture, and meet other people and maybe get together with someone else who might help you in whatever your enterprise happens to be, whether it's graphic design or writing or what have you. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think these co-working facilities are there for. They're like gym memberships. You pay to go to one. You pay for a desk. I mean, that in a way is pretty astonishing. It shows that people may get out of offices, but they still have sort of an office inside them that they want to access.
Your inner office, right?
Your inner office, yeah.
Nikhil, I have this sort of uncomfortable feeling that the way this trend is going is the disappearance of the office completely. We're going to knock down the walls, open up the office, then we're going to freelance more and not even have to go into the office. Pretty soon, all you need is a plug, or maybe not even that.
It's not implausible, that kind of future. I sort of am hesitant to say that anything is coming to an end or disappearing. I mean, it would be sort of too categorical. But it's true that already in our own lifetimes, we see work leaving the building envelope. In a way, it's just leaking out everywhere. Many of us are already working constantly and anywhere, and often far too much or all the time. You know, in a way that the office as such is becoming harder to justify. Certainly it's harder to justify these giant skyscrapers, although they keep building them, that suck a ton of energy and are wasteful and are not often used all the time. They have lights on all the time. We should be a little bit more comfortable with the idea that this is not a sustainable model and never really has been.
Nikhil Saval is the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.